In Florida, climate change has brought flooding and it's brought intensifying storms. But for the residents of Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood, climate change has brought another crisis: gentrification.
It's not that people didn't want to stay here, it's just the rent was so high.
Is that you move or you pay $1,000 more?
So what's making Little Haiti the hot new neighborhood? Well, it's the fact that it's located on high ground. And that's led to a boom in development, one that threatens to drive out those who've lived there a long time. But some people are fighting to protect Little Haiti's Haitian roots.
We have the legitimacy to be among the players that are changing our community. We want to be part of it.
We'll also hear from a woman who survived cancer, quit her job, took up paddleboarding, and then became an activist in a pretty unusual way.
I'd say the first sort of major challenge I decided to do was paddleboarding the length of England through the canals and rivers, through our connected waterways. So it was about a 400-mile journey right from the south of the country.
And we'll hear about how clean energy in Montana can actually transcend political divisions.
If I was to open my client book to you, the demographic completely different than what you might imagine. If I had to guess, 75% of my clients vote red.
And Mr. Green, our advice columnist, tells us why man's best friend might not be the environment's best friend. I'm Jason Mark, and this is The Overstory. Rising sea levels are usually a problem for people who live in low-lying coastal areas. But in South Florida, sea level rise is actually threatening residents at higher elevations, like Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood. You see, Little Haiti sits on relatively high ground, by Miami standards, that is, and it's become an attractive spot for developers. Reporter Jonathan Hahn went down to Miami to see how one group is stepping up to protect longtime residents from being displaced.
On a Sunday night in Miami, the glow of streetlights falls on a weekly drum circle. About 20 people are gathered in the courtyard of a huge open-air style Caribbean marketplace. Some people dance, some drum. Some stand outside the circle and chat as children play. This is the beating heart of Little Haiti.
This is my family, you know. I grew up in Miami.
Cubans, it was Africans. Our block was, we always call it Sesame Street.
Many residents refer to the neighborhood in their native Creole language, Tiayiti.
This is the legacy, this is the place that situates us in Miami-Dade County and even in the United States.
For Haitian immigrants, this neighborhood was a haven from an unstable and unsafe homeland.
Clearly, this was the platforms from which many successful lives were launched, both for them and their children.
We was able to survive, we beautified it, we worked, you know, with what we have. People were able to start businesses, restaurants.
Selling little drums and little snacks that remind you of Haiti, and now it's more of how to keep the funds going.
Now they're being displaced once again.
It's not that people didn't want to stay here, it's just the rent was so high.
It's either you move or you pay $1,000 more. And I've been there, living there for 25 years. They already changed the color of the buildings and they changed the green and yellow to this gray scheme, so it doesn't feel alive anymore.
Can you imagine a 28 stories over on the other side going up and the impact that it's going to have on this community?
This community is changing and changing rapidly. The cause is a new scourge brought by global warming. It's called climate gentrification. South Florida is uniquely vulnerable to rising sea levels. High tides are already flooding low-lying communities, some as often as twice a day. So as developers look to build, they look for high ground, which brings them to Little Haiti. This neighborhood stands at a whopping 10 feet above sea level, but it's the last best option when the rest of the city sits at an average 6 feet above sea level. Properties at higher ground are becoming more valuable. For residents, that means increased rent or pressure to sell your home.
You've lived somewhere where it's 30, 40 years, and then all of a sudden you got somebody knocking on your door every day asking you, do you want to sell? You know, I don't care how much money they get, you know, they're going to end up paying high rent or wherever else they go at, you know, and that little money's going to be gone in no time anyway, you know?
That's Michael Clarkson. He's one of the founders of Conscious Contractors, a collectively owned company that offers for-profit construction work and free cleanup and repairs for the community.
A lot of these people have not been able to have the proper upkeep of their houses. That's one of the aspects of one of our programs, beautification and revitalization of this area, to help people get their roofs fixed and put in storm windows and things like that so they can stay, so they don't get forced out of the community, you know?
Their work started in September 2017. As Hurricane Irma approached Miami, a handful of neighbors went door to door to board up windows and deliver supplies. The hurricane plowed a path of destruction through the neighborhoods, ripping up trees, flooding streets, and leaving millions without power. It was the strongest storm ever recorded in the Atlantic. In the days that followed, the same neighbors gathered again, this time to clear debris and fallen branches off cars and rooftops.
We were just skimming the area, just driving up and down, and we saw a tree on top of this van. We went to knock on the door, and all of a sudden we realized that this lady had survived the hurricane in her house by herself, and she's a double amputee. So we just asked her if we can cut a tree down her house.
Uhuru Concien Alexandre was one of the volunteers who helped neighbors during Hurricane Irma. He's one of the co-founders of Conscious Contractors, and he has seen the company grow to provide essential services the community depends on.
Then we just started asking folks, yo, how can we help you? Conscious Contractors is a company that came out of a necessity, which is now a year and a half, going on 2 years, understanding what is the need for our people around renovation of houses, maintaining the people in their houses, and also talking about health in regards to climate change and stuff like that.
But even with the work of Conscious Contractors, new development is putting pressure on a housing crisis that is already feeling the heat. Zalala Madefras is the resilience director at Catalyst Miami, a nonprofit anti-poverty organization. She leads workshops to educate and train community members to stand up against things like climate gentrification.
It doesn't take that much to be homeless. I think 70% of the city is renters, and we have a crisis.
Climate gentrification tightens the vise on social inequalities that already concern residents. Things like income disparity, lack of public transportation, and access to jobs. There's a dark irony at play here, too. Because Little Haiti, with its proximity to the railroad tracks, historically was the last place people wanted to live.
They were kind of pushed towards that railroad, towards that high elevation land, and of course, away from waterfront areas. So now with climate change, we're seeing a lot of land in Miami, but especially the high elevation land, become more and more valuable, which again is where people were literally forced, Black people were literally forced to live and to congregate and to build neighborhoods.
As developers move into this neighborhood of immigrants, they are pushing out the people who were forced to live here in the first place. But now there's such a premium on higher elevation properties that some of the city's poorest residents are getting offered cash for their homes, a hard thing to turn down.
Developers will go around knocking on people's doors, offering them cash for their house or cash and 6 months rent somewhere in the southern part of the county. Of course, like some people take the money and move. I'm sure others are more resolute in staying in place, but I think it's hard when you get offered like $250,000 in cash. People that are already like socioeconomically disadvantaged, but would have been safer as far as climate change goes and sea level rise are now physically, environmentally disadvantaged by being moved out of those areas. And a lot of folks move further south, which is extremely low-lying and a far distance from the urban core and a lot of jobs.
Many residents would prefer to keep living in their homes and in their neighborhood, which is why Conscious Contractors is trying to help residents stay. They want to play a part in Little Haiti's development.
In terms of the American dream, you know, one thing is having a house, having a home. We're doing our part in making sure that we have the legitimacy to be among the some of these players that are changing our community. We want to be part of it. Does our people know about climate change? Yes. Does our people know about how to be climate resilient? Yes. Are we part of the conversation in regards to how climate change is being exposed to them? No. And this is one of the reasons why we're on the ground to stand in the gap.
As they're rebuilding and renovating homes, they're sustaining the cultural legacy of the neighborhood. Even in the way they spell the company's name, Conscious Contractors, with K's instead of C's.
The K that you see is really an artistic expression of combining the English and the Creole together without changing the pronunciation of the word. You would read it and say, okay, these people are trying to tell you a story about their language.
And coming together to support each other in the face of adversity, that's part of the Haitian culture too.
Me'apil Shai Palu. It's a Haitian proverb that my mother, she was the one that raised me, and she raised me with proverbs. And the Me'apil Shai Palu comes from her having to say, let's put our hands together to do this. It's not necessarily like the physical sense, but it's understanding that there's so much work to do. How do we come together to do it?
For now, these many hands come together in another way.
Yeah, this community could change for the benefit of the people here instead of the benefit of the people on the outside. So our main thing is education, organization, and agitation, and then mobilizing people to, you know, solve the problem.
For The Overstory, I'm Jonathan Hahn.
That story was produced by Daniel Roth and Jonathan Hahn, managing editor here at Sierra Magazine, with help from Virginia Laura. To read Jonathan's full article, just go to our website, sierramagazine.org. Now, some tips on sustainable living from Mr. Green, our advice columnist. Today, we got a question from Wolf in Ecuador about the environmental impacts of man's best friend.
My question was if there's any research being done on the environmental impact, on the ecological impact or damage dogs have on our life in the whole country as far as fecal matter, disturbance of wildlife.
It is kind of amazing to me how little research has been done on the environmental impact of dogs. It's kind of strange, really, when you look into it. It's the most common domestic animal that we have, and yet we don't know much about it. My biggest recent discovery is what's called dog canker, and that is that dogs can actually kill trees by urinating or defecating at the base of the tree. And many trees are killed this way, that are especially smaller trees up to 6 inches in diameter. And they release ammonia, they release salt, and that eventually kills the tree if the dogs use the same location over and over, which they do because apparently they are communicating in various ways at the base of these trees. And so that's one of the most amazing newer discoveries that I've made.
Yeah. I lived at Lake Tahoe for 50 years. People come up to Tahoe, and it's open country, and the first thing they do is they let them run loose and think this is the great outdoors for them, you know. The dogs love it.
I'm sure they do. Then they're allowed to do their business anywhere out in the woods that they want to then, right?
You know what the latest fad is now? At every trailhead in hiking into the mountains and the public beaches too, there is these little plastic bags.
Yes.
Under every one of these signs telling people to collect the dog poop, they leave their little plastic bag there instead now.
Just walking with the dog through a woods eliminates a huge percent of the wildlife that is normally there you will not observe because your dog is scaring it away.
Yet people go for a walk in the woods to enjoy nature. Well, wildlife is part of nature.
I've always considered it to be so, yes.
You know, I grew up with dogs, too. I'm not a dog hater.
That's good. I wouldn't want people coming out to attacking you there.
I already have among my friends. We have a kind of an ecological organization going on, and we love the backcountry. And I say to them, a true ecologist does not own a dog. And some of my friends, they laugh at me. Some of them scold me. Some of them get mad at me. But that's... the way I look at things.
I think that's an interesting take. Maybe we'll publish an article in Sierra Magazine on this very topic. Well, anyway, it's been fun talking to you.
Well, thank you very much for considering this topic.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much.
That was Bob Shulgin with Ask Mr. Green. He's our advice columnist for sustainable living. To ask your question, just go online, sierramagazine.org. Brad Van Wert is the co-owner of Harvest Solar. It's an energy company that's got the challenge of selling solar to rural Montanans. Energy is pretty cheap there. Montana's a coal state. And here's how Brad describes it.
If you can sell solar in this market, it's somewhat of a ketchup popsicle to a woman in a white dress.
But Brad's found that some Montanans actually do want solar energy, and it's not necessarily who you'd expect. Brad says a lot of it has to do with the spirit of the people who live there in the Big Sky State.
People come to Montana for various reasons. Honestly, I drove through on a road trip and just decided to stay. The last best place, it's certainly called. Montanans have a very deep connection to the land and like feel a sense of ownership over it, and even more so, a sense of responsibility to take care of it. Montanans are a hardy bunch that are self-sufficient and are independent. Montanans hunt for elk to fill up their freezers. They grow a garden for their vegetables. They cut firewood to warm their homes. So producing your own clean energy on your own rooftop is very much like in line with those values. If I was to open my client book to you, the demographic completely different than what you might imagine. If I had to guess, 75% of my clients vote red. During the last election cycle, like five different systems with Trump signs in the front yard. In Montana, you have a lot of what we call like Folger can money. If you would imagine, these are the type of people that have like literally a Folger can under their bed that they just like put money into. Like a lot of like semi-rural areas in Montana, people like make a decent living and have a very low overhead, you know? And so it's like, I learned the lesson the hard way early on. Like I would make some judgment calls on people, and like maybe I wouldn't offer them like full attention, or I'd just kind of mail it in with a proposal or something like that and never hear from them again, and then drive by their house like 6 months later and they got an array on their house. And I'm like, wow, I really blew it, because I was over here like chasing like the people from that were walking out of the co-op, you know, completely wrong. And once I realized that, I was psyched, both financially because I could grow my business better, but also like there's people out there that just like walk their walk without, you know, not even worried about it. They're like, yeah, that's just what I'm doing. You know, and then there's a lot of people out there that like feel the need to like, they're like, oh, climate change and this and that. But again, it's like, dude, do you know what one plane ticket does? I'll be honest, I think that, like, it's ideological at the core of it for most people. However, the economics of it have helped allow more people to enter the space, regardless of like political affiliations or whether or not they even believe in climate change. Deep connection to the land, feeling of responsibility to take care of this place. Last best place, what does part of that mean? Like free and clean and, you know, refreshing. And it's like, so do what you can to make sure it stays that way.
About 5 years ago, Lizzie Carr had an office job. She spent a lot of time on email. She didn't get outside all that much. Today, she's a world-class paddleboarder who started a movement to fight plastic pollution. So how did it happen? Sierra's story editor, Wendy Bechtel, talked with Lizzie at her home outside of London.
Lizzie, tell us how you became an environmental activist.
It all really started back in about 2013 after I was diagnosed with cancer. And then from there, sort of my life just took a completely different turn, really. After I'd finished my radioactive iodine treatment, my radiotherapy, I went to the Isles of Scilly where my dad lives. It's a tiny little island just off the end of Cornwall. I really just went there just for a bit of downtime to recover in sort of peace. And I sat on a beach with him one day, just looking out into the water, and I saw somebody in the distance paddleboarding. And I think it was the first time I'd really seen it in real life. And I just sort of said to my dad, I really, really want to try that. Like, it looks so calming and relaxing. So I just sort of went over to the local paddling club and asked to borrow a board. And just, you know, I hadn't done it before. I just kind of said, I just want to give it a try. You know, I won't be long. Can I just borrow the board and bring it back? As soon as my paddle was sort of in the water and I started paddling along, I think it was a huge game changer for me. And it was just allowing me the time to really think and remove myself from what was happening day to day.
So after you stayed with your father for a while, did you then return to London and go back to work?
Yeah, exactly that. I went straight back to work and then just paddleboarded on the waterways
in the evenings, at the weekends, just whenever I could, really. I didn't actually know I could paddleboard on the waterway until I got back to London and started Googling it.
People in the United States, when they think of London, they probably don't realize you can paddleboard in London.
Yeah, so obviously we've got the River Thames, which is kind of just the arterial river that runs through the centre of London. And then we have a network of man-made canals that were built, you know, hundreds of years ago to basically connect the different parts of the country inland. But they are, for me, I think, real like pockets of nature in a lot of otherwise very densely populated urban areas. But then obviously that was really where my first experience and understanding of the issue of plastic came from. And I would paddle up and down those canals. I would just see plastic everywhere. It would get caught on my board. I'd paddle past birds' nests made up almost entirely of plastic wrappers. I'd see swans kind of chewing at plastic bags. So it was really horrifying because obviously I was using this water, I was using this place to kind of restore my health. And, you know, it's my happy place, a place to go and feel good. And the experience was constantly marred by what I was seeing around me.
How did you decide that you wanted to work on this problem?
I think it was just thinking, how can I show people what I'm seeing? How can I get people to understand what this looks like? You know, where do I start with this? And then just kind of came up with this idea that if I took all these photographs on these routes and traveled this distance, that I could like present to people and almost kind of shock them into understanding. I'd say the first sort of major challenge I decided to do was paddleboarding the length of England through the canals and rivers, through our connected waterways. So it was about a 400-mile journey right from the south of the country. And I'm sure everyone that I knew just thought I'd completely lost the plot. It's like, what's happened? You know, she's just survived this illness and now she's doing all this crazy stuff. I wanted to do that journey because I wanted to draw attention to the problem inland and show people that this is where it all starts. You know, 80% of marine debris is coming from inland sources. So that must be coming from somewhere, and that's mostly our home. So if I'm paddling this journey and it's kind of me as a solo individual on this mission and photographing and logging every piece of plastic I see on that route, then I build an evidence base that shows people what this problem looks like on their doorsteps and how they've contributed to that.
Did people start to pay attention?
There wasn't much interest in it. It was still such an under-discussed topic and people just didn't really understand it or why I cared so much about it. But as the journey went on, and I think more and more people became aware of it and heard about it, the response snowballed. And, you know, by the end, people were tracking me on my website to see where I was and coming out to meet me with flapjacks and drinks, and people were donating to the cause. And by the time I finished, it really felt like I'd achieved something physically, but also I'd made the point I wanted to make, and people were talking about my challenge in the context of environmental activism. And, you know, my paddleboarding journey was a vehicle to really get people discussing plastics, and it had worked.
So after you finished your trip, what did you decide to do next?
I analysed all of my results and I had a look at where sort of the four or five hotspots around the UK that I'd paddled were. And I revisited those four places in the end and with my paddleboard again, and just litter picked on my own over like 3 or 4 days, all the rubbish that I found in them. I was really on my own. And then all of a sudden, a lot of people were asking me how they could get involved on the ground as well and what they could do to be part of it. So I borrowed my boyfriend's van and some paddleboards and just went around the country armed with sort of 5 or 6 paddleboards and just said to people on social media, you know, if you want to come and join me and get involved, I've got some paddleboards, join me litter picking. And every year that's grown and grown, and I've got a few more boards now and more volunteers. I do it in more places, there's more communities involved, and it's just really incredible how that's all just organically grown since it started. There was a moment, I think, earlier this year where I was out on the water in London, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and there was probably about 40 of us on the water. So we'd had people that had signed up and borrowed boards, and then loads of local paddlers that had just come out on their own to join in as well. And I sort of just took a moment, stood back and just thought, wow, like, it makes me a bit emotional now. Like, I've created this. And it was just, I've never really looked at it like that, because it's always been very functional. Like, it's always just been like the eye on getting the job done and sort of feeling like there's still so much to do. But to kind of have that moment where you separate yourself from it finally and just look around you and think, all these people are doing this and helping because they believe in what I believe. It's really quite, it's quite emotional.
So you founded the organization Plastic Patrol. What is that?
Plastic Patrol is a not-profit that I set up that really just started as a hashtag Plastic Patrol when I began campaigning a few years ago. And it's just evolved now into really what I would say is a grassroots community activism movement that aims really to understand a lot more about plastic pollution and what that looks like through scientific data collection that we then analyse to understand a bit more about, you know, the brands that are kind of creating this problem, the hotspots around the world that we're finding plastic is congregating, and doing something about it.
We started this interview talking about your illness and talking about cancer, and it seems like that experience, as traumatic as it was, really sort of gave you a new direction in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that my cancer diagnosis was the catalyst to everything that I've done since. I think I always say that cancer was my worst nightmare, but my greatest blessing. I never would have believed that I'd be thankful for what I went through. But obviously, as the years have gone on and I've sort of lived through it, I can look back now and just see how much of an impact that's had, a positive impact that's had, both like on my life and the decisions that I've made since then.
Lizzie, it was such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sierra Magazine's own Wendy Bechtold speaking with Lizzie Carr. Lizzie's online at lizzieoutside.co.uk. Check her out. And now, as always, we're going to close the show with a soundscape from Bernie Krause. This here is Corkscrew Swamp, a spot near Naples, Florida. It's one of the lowest lying environments in a low-lying state, and that puts it at huge risk from rising sea levels. The Overstory is produced by Josephine Holtzman and Isaac Kestenbaum at Future Projects Media, with help from Daniel Roth. Special thanks to Virginia Laura. Our theme music is by Jeff Bradsky. This episode was mixed by Dara Hirsch. I'm Jason Mark, and I'll be back later this year with the second season of The Overstory.